Today I have with me Frank Snedarczyk. Frank is a registered professional electrical engineer in the state of Pennsylvania. During his years working in the energy sector, he has personally witnessed the limitations and decline of American industry. Frank has also written numerous peer-reviewed and non-peer-reviewed articles on cold fusion, anti-gravity, and foundational physics. By exploring these topics in depth, he believes that mankind can achieve an age of abundance in the not-too-distant future. Frank, thank you for being with me today.
Thank you very much, Don, for inviting me on your show. It's a privilege.
Can you give our listeners maybe an overview of your background and some of your credentials?
Yes. I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of Pennsylvania. That's in the University of Pittsburgh. I've also have a business degree from St. Francis University in Pennsylvania. And I have attended Indiana University in physics. I got about 30 credits to fill in the gaps where the engineering degree didn't cover. I also have maybe 35 years of industrial experience working in mines, mills, as an engineer, lastly with power plants, startup, and power plant designs. And so I've experienced a lot of I work directly in energy production facilities in this country.
Now, can you give us a little bit of an idea of what it was like working in the energy sector and your perspective on the energy alternatives that are currently touted today as the solutions to our problems?
Yeah. All the energy solutions today depend on fossil fuels or renewables. Fossil fuels have environmental impacts. They all do, and they're limited. Renewable energies are not quite economic. They require a lot of materials, manpower, and so they're never going to provide the cheap, free energy to keep our society growing and the economy growing. So we're in a bind. One thing someone always asks me is, with the new energy coming out, and your experience in the energy industry, do you find conspiracies to suppress the new energy? And I've been in meetings with vice presidents of electric companies, and I said, we need to look into this. And their comment is, we need to make a profit. We have a system here. Let's increase the efficiency of what we have. So they're not into exploring new ideas or new concepts that are not currently generating any revenue. They have to pay employees and pay their bills. And so it's not a conspiracy. They're just not interested in funding fundamental research.
Now, some of these new energy alternatives that you just mentioned, probably the most notable might be cold fusion or low energy nuclear reactions. And I know you've been investigating that at least since the early 90s. And you've also been investigating anti-gravity a bit, probably since the mid to late 90s. So can you let us know how you got into each of those fields?
Yes, I was interested in all new forms of energy, and the low-level nuclear reactions thing interested me because, first of all, the Pons and Fleischmann were renowned electrochemists, and when they came out and said they had something, I believed them. And in the early 90s, I got involved with the James Patterson Cold Fusion Energy Cell and Professor Miley from the University of Illinois. He's a brilliant man. And I saw what was going on in the field, and I believed that something was happening. There was a problem with the reproducibility. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Nobody understood the theoretical underpinnings process so that they could tune it up and get it to work every time. And the established mainstream community said, this cannot happen. In order to have fusion, we have to have temperatures approaching four times the interior of the sun, or we have to have a lot of neutrons, radiation, and other signatures of the reaction. So this field was sort of pushed off to the side, and I kept following it. I believed that there was something to it. And I've always been interested in anti-gravity as an electrical engineer. If you read books in the early 19th century with Einstein's theory that control of anti-gravity was going to happen any day, anti-gravity packs to put on your back and people were going to fly around, this never happened. Anti-gravity proved to be more difficult than expected. And now even science fiction writers don't write about anti-gravity anymore. The appeal of this is gone. But as an electrical engineer, I know about the control of the electromagnetic forces. I'm very well versed at that. And I attempted to apply what I knew about the electromagnetic force to the control of the gravitational force. And I found some pretty amazing things. I traveled down to NASA Marshall, and I witnessed their Podkletnov replication experiment. That was an interesting trip. I got to see things there at NASA, and I also got to see things at the Patterson and Miley. And I felt that there wasn't many new things coming down the pike, but this was one new phenomenon, and the anti-gravity effect and the cold fusion effect were different aspects of the same phenomena.
Now, you use your theory of the quantum transition to explain both low energy nuclear reactions and anti-gravity. Can you maybe get into a little bit about the nuts and bolts of that theory, and then how does it explain both of these reactions or phenomenon?
Okay, that's a very good question, John. I always start with my work at the conservation laws. And the conservation law says what's possible and what's not possible. And anything that isn't bounded by the conservation laws is mandatory. Conservation laws say that you have to conserve energy. You can't get something from nothing. One of the big ones that Newton came up with is the conservation of momentum. Momentum is mass times velocity. For every action, there will be an equal reaction, and it's always conserved. But the static fields, that would be the gravitational field and the electromagnetic field, are always conserved. And so if you have a dielectric between two plates of a capacitor, it only reduces the electrostatic field by imposing the field of the opposite polarity. It's not possible to increase the strength of the static electromagnetic field. So when I was in college, well, this goes back to the 70s, I was sitting in class with George Osteller, and he was explaining a radio frequency transformer. He said, well, we get the inductance of the primary, and then we add the inductance of the secondary, and I thought, well, I can do that. Then we have to add a new term, a mutual term, that arises out of nowhere. And I thought, oh no, more stuff, another formula, nothing's easy. That bothered me for a lot of years. And I saw that magnetism appears, this mutual effect, mutual electrical engineers call it, it comes out of nowhere, ex nihilo. When you turn an electromagnet on, where does the magnetism come from the battery? When you turn the electromagnet off, where does the magnetism go? Does it go back into the battery? The answer is no, it comes from nowhere. And if you look at our technology, we have this static electric field. It's very weak. You can maybe rub a balloon on your head and stick it on a wall. And that's about all it's good for. It's not very powerful. But Edison, Siemens, and the original inventors found that the magnetic component can be increased with soft iron. That amplifies the strength of the magnetic field by a factor of 10,000. And so we're able to increase the force of magnetism. Magnetism is not a conserved property of the universe. And so if you had two electromagnets sitting on a table and you added a piece of soft iron, you'd get more magnetism. It would be like if you had $2 sitting on the table and you added a quarter, another dollar magically appeared. And the electromagnetic force is not conserved. And so I applied that theory to the other fields, the gravitomagnetic force and the strong nuclear force. The magnetic component of these forces has the same structure as the electromagnetic force, but it's not the same force. The gravitomagnetic force is the magnetic component of the gravity. It affects all matter. And it's very weak, 10 to the 39th power weaker than the electromagnetic force. And the magnetic component of the nuclear force is called the spin orbit force. And that tends to make even numbered nucleons more stable. But I also realize that the magnetic component of these forces is not conserved. And under the right condition, we may be able to amplify these magnetic forces in range and strength and apply them classically. And I wasn't sure how to do this. I know a superconductor dramatically affects the range and strength of the electromagnetic field. For instance, it has a zero magnetic permeability. It expels magnetic fields completely to the surface. Because it has no resistance, the electromagnetic field is entirely confined. But a superconductor has no impact, no effect on gravity or the strong nuclear force. So there was something missing from this. And then when I went to see Patterson cold fusion cell and down to the National Witness Center, plot Kleppenhoff experiments, I was looking to see, is there a secret ingredient that needs to be added to the superconductor in order to make it affect all the natural forces?
And so this is how you arrived at your quantum transition theory, yes?
Yes. What I noticed, the superconductor just sits there, but if you kick it, it's in a state of transition. It's moving. If you kick a bell, it rings, it's in a state of transition. But when you kick a superconductor, and you get it moving mechanically, it's in a state of quantum transition. And what I noticed about Patterson's cell is they were 50 nanometer size, and it was hitting them with thermal energy. Product of the thermal frequency, which is about 10 to the 13 hertz, so the mid-infrared band, times the domain size, which is around 10 to 50 nanometers, equals the velocity of 1 million meters per second. And then when I went down to NASA Marshall and I looked at the Kleppenhoff replications, he was using radio waves. He was using 3 megahertz radio waves on a 1/3 of a meter disk, completely different scale, 1/3 of a meter versus nanometers, but the velocity, the product of the frequency times the wavelength, was the velocity that seemed to work in these anti-gravity experiments. The way that you have to kick a superconductor to get it in transition is to induce this velocity of 1 million meters per second. I wasn't sure what it meant. Then I applied it to the atom and the quantum jumps, and I was able to produce the spectrum of all the atoms from this velocity that I observed in cold fusion. And that addressed a lot of issues that were outstanding for a number of years.
Now, how and why does the transition occur? Because that seems like something of a mystery, and you seem to describe it as something called an impedance match.
Yes. That's a good question. If you bounce a ball off the Earth is heavy, it doesn't rebound, and the ball will bounce and bounce and give off a series of thumps every time it bounces. And if you hit that's called a non-impedance match system. The same thing occurs in power lines. That's where I'm familiar with it. When you send it from the power plant, you send some power to Walmart. You don't want it bouncing from Walmart and coming back. You want to stay there with the customer. Now, an impedance match system, technically, would be when one billiard ball hits another and it stops. The first ball stops, and the second ball flies away with all the kinetic energy. So the characteristic of an impedance match system is all the energy exchanged in one instant. And with that cue ball, you get one snap of sound when it hits, one crack. Now, with atoms, they get one photon and it changes state. Not one photon and an electron bounces and another one when it bounces again. It happens in one single step. And so I knew from my observations of electrical energy flowing and my observations of mechanical systems that the quantum transition was an impedance matched. So now the thing about this impedance matched system is that the density of the interacting partners has to be incoming ball in the billiard table hits the other ball and it flies away with the same velocity. That's an impedance match system. So I applied this concept of impedance matching, and the velocity that I used was the one I observed in cold fusion, 1 million meters per second. Applying those concepts simultaneously in my mathematics, I was able to come out with the wave-like properties of light, the particle-like properties of light, and all of the atomic energy levels. And so through the mathematics was extended across the domain of quantum physics.
And from this, you were able to derive certain constants such as Planck's constant and the photon energy level, correct?
Yes. That's interesting because in ordinary life, so you want to drive your car and you want to go 40 miles an hour and you want to go a little faster, you push the gas, you can go 45, you can go 42, you can go any speed you want. But when electrons jump on the small scale, they jump between certain levels. They can't jump halfways, and they have this lumpiness to the quantum world that's set by Planck's constant. Now, Planck's constant is known with a great deal of precision, maybe to 15 digits. However, it is an empirical constant. It does not arrive from a Newtonian view of the universe. You can't derive it from ordinary classical principles. In order to make some stuff, this various interpretations were implied, saying that the quantum realm is the real realm, and we really can't understand why it jumps, but it does. And the things that we see in ordinary life are a subset of this mysterious quantum realm. But the quantum realm is what it is, but we'll never be able to understand it in classical principles. And the classical principles arrive when the quantum is smeared out. Einstein never knew this in the EPR paper. He felt that quantum mechanics was a subset of the classical realm, but there was some hidden variables associated in this classical universe that would be applied to the quantum realm that would make quantum physics arrive from classical mechanics.
Now, what is so mysterious about the photon and how and why it's emitted?
Well, the photon is sort of funny because it's a wave and a particle simultaneously. The first experiments were done with double slits and they passed light waves through these. Thomas Young did this and he found that a wave-like interference pattern on the screen. When they passed the photon through a single slit, they got dispersion where the wave went through the slit and spread out. And so they were convinced in the 19th century that light was a wave. And then when Einstein came along, he found that light behaved like a particle. Newton also believed this, but he didn't have any experimental evidence to prove it. So now light is a wave and a particle. These ideas are separate. They're not something you can put together. It's sort of a mystery. It reminds me of the Holy Trinity in the church. It's a mystery that can't be resolved. And the thing about light is the energy of the light is proportional to the frequency. So if you're sitting under a heat lamp, even though it's very intense, you won't get a sunburn. But if you're out in the sun, even when the sun isn't intense, you get a burn because there's more energy. Now, the energy of a classical wave is proportional to a little wave hits you. It doesn't do much damage. If a giant wave hits you, it will knock you over because it's very high and has a lot of amplitude. And so quantum systems, the energy is proportional to frequency. Classical systems, the energy is proportional to amplitude. And even another mystery is when you're hearing my voice, you're hearing the vibration of the speaker. The speaker matches my voice and vibrates the air at the same frequency as the cone. Well, in the atom, there is nothing that vibrates at the frequency of the emitted photon. The photon sort of emerges from a mysterious quantum effect, but no orbit or combination of orbits has the right vibrational frequency or a frequency that matches that of emitted photon. And so all these quantum mysteries are sort of embedded into current quantum theory. And they're best summed up by an argument of Feynman, who said that no matter how you look at it, you'll wind up down the drain in a dark alley from which no one has ever emerged.
Can you elaborate a bit more on the magnetic component of the gravitational force and the strong nuclear force? Because I think that is something probably a lot of people are not well acquainted with, especially the gravitomagnetic force.
What's interesting about these forces is that they carry the momentum of the movement. For instance, an electron moves along and the magnetic field follows behind it and has what they call curl. It goes around in a circle and that carries the momentum or the impetus of the electron. So in your automotive spark coil, the electrons are moving along and they interrupt the circuit. And this momentum that's carried by this magnetic force tends to drive the electrons forward, and they drive forward at high voltage and leap out in your spark plug. And so that's what goes on in electromagnetic force. And in gravitomagnetic force, there's also a magnetic component that follows behind. And many have proposed that this gravitomagnetic component carries the momentum of matter. And this force has a similar structure to the electromagnetic force in that it makes a little circle. If you drew little lines on a paper, it would look the same, but it's an entirely different force. It has different properties. It's 10 to the 39th power weaker than the electromagnetic force. Now, the nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, has the same kind of deal where it has a magnetic component. It's not of electromagnetic origin, but it has the same structure. Like two magnets that tend to spin and lock together, this magnetic force in the nucleon tends to couple nucleons together in pairs. And so even number nucleons are more stable. They have a little line. It's called A to Z curve. And right in the middle is the most stable. And what current science says is the electromagnetic force is mutable. You can put soft iron and increase it. But the strong nuclear, the magnetic component, is not mutable. And I say, yes, it is. Conservation laws in electromagnetic example demonstrate that it is. But we have to find the condition. And the gravitomagnetic force is always 10 to the 39th power weaker than the electromagnetic force, which is vanishingly small. And that's not mutable. And I think I found the condition under which they're mutable, and that is this quantum jump. And that's when you kick the superconductor and send it into vibration. It's the same thing that happens in the atom. And what happens when the electron jumps in a single step is the electric field moves, which is a transverse wave. The mechanical forces move, which is a longitudinal wave, which is a sound wave. And the velocities of the transverse and the longitudinal waves are equal. The forces are the same during the transition, and that allows the transition to occur in a single step. And so what I'm saying is, during transition, the strength of the gravitomagnetic force increases dramatically. The strength of the electromagnetic force is profoundly affected, and the range of the strong nuclear spin orbit force increases in range. And that allows the transition to occur in a single step. And I can see that occurring in an atom, and I show that through the mathematics. And then I say, well, if you get a superconductor and you kick it, you also put the superconductor into a state of motion. And a superconductor is a macroscopic atomic quantum state, or macroscopic Bose-Einstein quantum state. When you put that into transition, the effect on the gravitomagnetic, the spin orbit magnetic, and the electromagnetic is extended. And this vibrating superconductor then becomes the soft iron equivalent for the other forces. And then once we understand that, we can engineer that, we can control all the forces, and that'll propel us into a new age of wonder.
In low energy nuclear reactions, the idea that a Bose-Einstein condensate type of environment is being created, has that been verified, or is that really just theoretical at this point? Is there anything in your mind that proves that a palladium cathode can be transitioned into a superconductor?
There's been a lot of work in this area, starting in the 70s. Italian researcher Sinati actually demonstrated a superconductivity in small regions within a proton conductor. So superconductivity has been observed many times over many years over small regions within a proton conductor. So we know it's there. Now, the problem with cold fusion is, I get to the superconductivity, is that it doesn't emit any high energy radiation, no gamma rays. And say you drive a car over a speed bump, you get a thump like a bang. You pass over the speed bump, and that bang is an emitted sound. Same thing happens in an atom when the electron passes over this Coulombic potential well. That's the electrostatic propulsion. It goes over there like a thump, and instead of emitting sound, it emits a gamma ray. There's no way to get over that except under one condition. And George Mathos of the University of Indiana pointed this out. He passed over the barrier without even noticing it. The problem with extending the range of the strong nuclear force is it would crush matter out of existence. So we can't do that. And the static force is conserved. We can't get any more of it. When you realize that the magnetic component, the spin orbit force, is not conserved, and there is a condition where we can increase the range of and strength of the nuclear spin orbit force, the range can be extended over a cluster of nucleons. Now you have a force that can bypass the Coulombic potential well, running over a speed bump, can exchange energy between nucleons without producing any radiation. And that's the mechanism I see in cold fusion. And amazingly, that's the mechanism I also see occurring in atomic transitions and atomic jumps.
So when we stimulate a Bose-Einstein condensate at a constant vibration, basically it keeps it in a perpetual state of transition. Is that right?
Yes, yes. So I went down to see how put off about a Bose-Einstein condensate. Just there, frozen up. It wasn't very interesting. It wasn't doing anything. It's not quite as amazing when you see it as it appears on television. But then when you give it a bump, put it into transition, that's not an ordinary state of transition. That is a state of quantum transition, and that is a macroscopic particle. And so what you're doing is you're putting trillions of atoms into a single state of quantum transition. And if you do that properly, it acts like a superconductor to all the forces. All the magnetic components are expelled to the surface. You'd have your magnetic component, like in a regular superconductor, expelled, and you have your spin orbit force expelled to the surface, and you have your gravitomagnetic force expelled to the surface. And from the surface, they act strongly on the cluster of nucleons and can be employed classically within machinery.
Now, in certain LENR systems where the nanoparticles are not exactly at that 50, I'm forgetting the exact number, but they're not at the exact size that you use to calculate your quantum transition state speed. Does that mean you have to adjust the vibration, or does your vibration hold in all systems?
Well, the product of the dimension and the vibration equals 1 million meters per second. If you have smaller particles, you've got to run the thing a little hotter. For the longest time, before this was known, Pons and Fleischmann were using just large clumps of palladium. Then it became apparent that it works better with nanoparticles. That was the work of Arata. And lately, most recently, Andrea Rossi, George Miley, and Deflat Kalon, it's a company, have used nanometer-sized particles. They have to preheat them to get them working. And as a matter of fact, the problem is that once it starts working, it gets hotter, and then it works better. It runs away. It's very difficult to control. And so it's a combination of size and temperature to achieve the cold fusion effect. And of course, it's the product of the size and the temperature equals 1 million meters per second. And that's the velocity that I discovered of the quantum jump, the velocity of the atom jumps between states, the electron jumps between states and the atom. So these are vastly different experiments that have a rather large footprint and extends across a wide swath of physics.
Now, jumping back to anti-gravity just for a moment, assuming that we're able to actually achieve anti-gravity, does it do us any good if we can't go faster than the speed of light? I mean, can any human being survive an interplanetary journey anyway if we're not exceeding the speed of light? So does your theory allow for superluminosity?
Yes, it does. And that's a little more speculative on the way out. Closer to where we need to go next is energy production and maybe inducing a gravimetric effect. But as an electrical engineer, I know that the momentum of an electron is carried by the inductance of a circuit. So if I have a transistor and I have electrons going in the primary, they appear to have a lot of mass. And the current is limited. It doesn't flow through the primary because these massive electrons don't want to move very much. But if I short the secondary out and I kill the flux in the core, then I get a lot of current in the primary, which makes the mass of the electrons in the primary appear less. Now, if the momentum of matter is carried by the gravitomagnetic component of the gravitational field, and it is in reaction to the rest of the universe, and if I would induce a field of opposite polarity so that I would reduce the gravitomagnetism of moving matter, then momentum is always conserved, so the spaceship or the matter would have to move faster in order to induce the same reaction to the rest of the universe. And so once we start to control gravity, we're going to be able to control gravitational mass and inertial mass. They're one and the same. They're linked together by Einstein's principle of equivalence. One affects the other. And as a matter of fact, when I have the electrons jumping from state to state, and I do my mathematics and I say that the velocities are like one cue ball hitting another cue ball, I don't really mention the mass of the cue balls, but it's important. The mass of the incoming cue ball equals the mass of the outgoing cue ball. Equations don't work when I conserve inertial mass. So during the quantum transitions, the mathematics is telling me that inertial mass is not conserved, and that inertial mass is not conserved during the vibration of a superconductor. You can get anomalous gravitomagnetic effects and anomalous effects with inertial mass. And this is okay, because inertial mass is not a conserved property. In special relativity, when something goes faster, it gains inertial mass. So it comes and goes. We never had a technology that can reduce inertial mass, but it lies within the conservation law, as all my work does. And I'm saying this state of quantum transition now can reduce or increase inertial mass. It provides a mechanism possibly to reduce inertial mass to the point of zero when we can move to the next star at luminal velocities or greater.
Again, just to clear this up a little bit, how do we distinguish between the gravitomagnetic and the electromagnetic force in that if mass is just a conglomeration of electrical charge, what is really the difference there?
What happens is if you have two electrons interacting, let's say that one's here and one's in another galaxy, there's a small interaction, and you move one, the disturbance takes a long time to reach the other, but the other one is in the field of the first. And so when the one electrostatic force moves, it doesn't matter what kind of field it is, gravitomagnet, nuclear spin orbit, or electromagnetic, it takes a while for the disturbance to propagate to the other. And so during that interval, the original static forces are not able to conserve momentum. Momentum is always conserved. Faraday discovered that only changing electric field induces an electromagnetic force. He didn't know why time was coupled with the magnetic force. Now we understand it, that magnetic force emerges as needed to conserve the momentum of two interacting force field bodies during the interval when the original static forces cannot. And that's the same mechanism that's in play with all the forces, whether it's the gravitomagnetic force, the electromagnetic force, or the nuclear spin orbit force. The forces are different entirely. The magnetic components have different effects, different range. But the mechanism used to conserve momentum between the interacting partners is the same with all forces. And this gravitomagnetic force is not conserved. The electromagnetic force, it comes and goes as needed to conserve the momentum of the system. And from the electromagnetic example, we know that we can increase the strength of the electromagnetic field with soft iron. There is or must be another condition that increases the strength of the gravitomagnetic force or increases the range of the strong nuclear spin orbit force. And I think I've discovered that condition, and that's the vibrating Bose condensate. That's the soft iron equivalent for all the other forces.
Now, you explored this idea a little bit in your book, the idea that the Big Bang emerging from quantum fluctuation implies that perhaps we're embedded in a Bose-Einstein condensate. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I don't know that, but it's very interesting to study energy. Energy is conserved, but where did it come from in the beginning? How did it start? Religious people say that, well, God appeared, made something out of nothing, and only he and his presence was able to do that. Well, science doesn't address these questions. They say, how could something have come from nothing without violating the conservation laws, particularly the conservation of energy? And the great scientist Edward Tryon said, he proposed that the universe was a vacuum fluctuation, where the positive energy of the universe balanced its negative gravitational potential. Sort of like if you drove your car down in the valley and charged the battery, you had energy. But if you ever tried to use that battery on a motor, you could never get out of the valley, because just when you got to the edge, you'd use all the energy in the battery. So we're stuck here in this hole, this gravitational hole called the universe. Then that begs the question, as we understand this Genesis process, is it possible to create new energy and new matter out of nothing? What holds us back? One of the things that we need to do when we do this is make more gravity to make things fall deeper in the hole. And when we can start to understand that a vibrating superconductor increases the gravitomagnetic component of the gravitational field, is there a way to use this strong local gravitomagnetic field to induce, put the universe deeper in the hole and make more energy? And that's sort of a speculative question. I'm still thinking about that, but it may be possible. Man, it may be within man's grasp and abilities to produce something out of nothing. And when we do that, we'll have reached a power that was since antiquity exclusively that God's. And I see this kind of technology coming with this control. The power that man will have in his hand will be almost godlike.
Now, with the developments of, say, the Rossi technology, the Defcalion technology, there's also the Brillouin Corporation. There's a handful of companies that seem to be leading the charge into getting these low-energy nuclear reaction generators to market. So based on your experience in that sector, do you see one as leading the way? Which one do you think will hit the market first, and maybe when?
I've seen these companies come and go, many of them. They came, they went, and they didn't quite make it to market. But I think Rossi finally found an ingredient, something he adds to it that acts as a catalyst and makes it more possible. Something I don't understand. It's something to do with the material condition. And Deflect-Kalon worked together with Rossi, and they learned what that special ingredient is. And both of them seem to be having some independent tests to demonstrate that their product appears to be working. But there's been a lot of speculation. Do they have it? Do they not? Brillouin just had a web thing where they said that their device is working, and it was independently confirmed by SRI, but I haven't seen anything from SRI stating that. So these people are working on the fringe of science. They don't know how to control the reaction, but they appear to be producing results. I saw results very early on with Patterson cell in 1995, but the same problems arose. It worked sometimes it didn't. And he didn't really understand the underlying physics, and so he couldn't adjust or tweak the process to get it work consistently. We're still there. We're still shooting in the dark.
The Patterson cell, did you see a major flaw with it? Were you able to decipher why he was being inconsistent with it, or is it just kind of this general problem we were not completely sure what we're dealing with yet?
We were not completely sure what we're dealing with yet, and even my work says it has to do with this gravitomagnetism, and the equations are very fundamental, saying, like the laws of motion, if you burn fuel, it'll make heat. But to actually get that to drive an internal combustion engine, you have to worry about the fine details. And we're finding them through trial and error. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of money. There's millions going into hot fusion and inertial confinement fusion, but mainstream scientists see this as being possible. And where they're making their mistake is they only consider the static forces. They only consider the static nuclear force, the static electromagnetic. So when you only consider the static forces, cold fusion is impossible. And they don't consider the dynamic magnetic components. And they don't consider that maybe these are mutable. But once you start to look at cold fusion through another lens, that there is another force at work, and this other force is able to expedite the process, then you have another theoretical construct. They're at the point where they don't want to look through Galileo's telescope. They look at the stars like from their eyes, like they always have, and they're looking at fusion and hot fusion scientists through the prism of static nuclear and static electromagnetic forces are the only ones at work. what they don't even consider is these dynamic forces, the magnetic effect. I call them dynamic because they're associated with movement. These dynamic forces are there, and they're mutable. Me being an electrical engineer, that's every day. You know, the magnetic component is mutable. I have soft iron in my generators, I have it in my speakers. I can see it. So I come from a different perspective. And I say, well, gee whiz, there's magnetic components in these other forces that are mutable. But now we actually understand what the condition is. And that's what I added. The condition to mutate these four to make them stronger is the vibrating superconductor, the vibrating Bose condensator.
Now, you're also good acquaintances with Dr. George Miley, and Dr. George Miley was one of the first to bring attention to transmutations taking place in LENR systems. And you were there for one of his initial presentations on that phenomenon, and I was wondering what the response was.
Okay, well, one of the first places I went was to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base when Miley introduced his research. What it was a U-shaped curve right in the middle of the heavy elements. It was as if several nucleons had got together, fused together, and made a super heavy nucleon beyond anything that anybody else made. And then that super heavy nucleon split apart through a process of fission. And the daughter products then fell on this curve, this U-shaped curve. Some were lighter, some were heavier. In order to get this U-shaped curve, that's a common thing for fission. You have like a glass, let's say glass, and you break it, you'll get some smaller pieces and some larger pieces. The glass is in the middle, and then the daughter products, the heavier pieces and the smaller pieces, are on either side of the curve. That's sort of what's going on. So he said it was a fission-fusion process involving the fusion of many nucleons into a compound nucleus, and this compound nucleus then split apart into smaller pieces. And of course, it's like really crazy because there is no such thing as a compound nucleus, and if such a thing would occur in a split, we'd have enormous amount of radiation, which there is none. And so the mainstream scientific community back on Miley and said, gee whiz, your experiments are contaminated because the amount of products produced are very, very small. And just a little contamination in this water would go into these electrodes and produce anomalous results. But Miley countered and said he had some element produced, like zinc 64, that weren't found in nature, that had a number of neutrons that shouldn't exist at all. And I thought, wow, at that point, the scientific community is going to really focus on Miley's work, but it was poo-pooed, and they said maybe Miley had gone mad, but Miley had not gone mad. His results were impeccable. They might have suffered a little bit by contamination. These are very difficult experiments, but he did show that elements were produced that weren't found in nature and that something was going on. That was done in 1996, and there still hasn't been major interest in the field since then, major interest involving capital or money, and I'm very disappointed.
So maybe we can begin to wrap up a little bit. I would like to know about maybe some current projects you're working on.
Thank you very much. I was working with the Sydney Kimmel Group. A girl, Emily Christmas, was there, was looking at some of my ideas. I have some ideas on how to control the reaction, prevent it from running away thermally. And I have a provisional patent, and I'm working to develop this and bring it to a full-time patent. I'm still a way off. I published a book on this material and the science. That's at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It sells for $10. I couldn't even photocopy it, bind it, put a cover on it, send it out for that price. So it's really cheap. Gives you a great overview. I'm very optimistic that something's going to happen, but again, I'm pessimistic because I saw this field unfold since 1990. And since 1990, we had a tremendous computer revolution with cell phones and the internet, and so many things have happened. And cold fusion appears to be in the same state it was in 1990. Great hope, but just around the corner, never quite here. I hope that ends and this great hope turns to reality.
And what kind of world do you see when it does come to reality?
If we learn how to classically control all the natural forces, I see it actually impacting us and making us a different kind of species. We'll be able to make something out of nothing. We'll be able to travel to the planets and maybe the stars. We'll become an interstellar species. Energy will be almost free. The control of the electromagnetic forces propelled us into this age of wonder. The control of all the natural forces will extend us to points where we can't even believe. For instance, I'm at the point now where understanding this control of gravito magnets, it was like Faraday did. He rubbed the glass rod with the amber and he got a little bit of static. But Faraday could never even begin to understand that a modern computer. So it was beyond his expertise. But when we control all these gravitational and spin orbit forces, and the technologies that follow are not even imaginable to me. But I know from the electromagnetic example of what has happened, it's going to be an ancient wonder beyond belief.
Do you think we'll be able to handle it responsibly?
That's always a problem, because all technology is a cutting-edge sword. When you have new technology, can be used to do good or bad, and increases your power to do both. And I think as we become more powerful with our technology, we're forced to be more responsible. For instance, we haven't had a nuclear attack since World War II because the power is too great, and we learned to rein it in so far. But you never know when the genie's going to be let out of the bottle, and the more technology that we have and the more powerful it becomes, in the wrong hands, it can be used to do an equal amount of damage. And I hope that never happens.
And I'm an optimist in that sense, in that it seems like the whole concept of mutually assured destruction overrides that ideological desire to destroy the other, destroy our enemies. On that level, I think that's a deterrent enough. I think we'll end there, Frank. Thank you so much for sharing your work and your ideas with us today.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure. Yeah. These are incredibly complex topics, and I try to simplify them as much as possible, and I hope your listeners enjoyed the show.
All right, thanks a lot, Frank. Take care.